Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
Danielle, are people overly excited because the January results on the stock markets were pretty positive?
Sure. I mean, people that lost money in 2022 are happy to see a rebound in the early part of the year. Of course, January was a pretty positive month. So I understand the impulse to say, yay, you know, we must be out of the woods and on to the next big bull recovery. But the problem with that is, of course, historically, that isn't borne out in any of the data. And what we see is, in fact, you know, you have to look at the big macro stuff that's going on in the world right now. And that tells us that when we look back in history, we've never seen a bear market low that has come before the central bank paused in the rate hiking cycle. So never mind, you know, they haven't even got to cutting yet, right? They're still in the tightening mode. U.S. Fed is going to announce another increase today in the overnight rate. They may indeed do that again in March. And then they may decide to pause, but typically, and if you look back, I posted a chart from Bloomberg, which was a lovely summary of this. Since 1929 through 2008, there were no less than 20 rallies in that period that were more than 15% in the S&P 500 that lasted anywhere from 300 plus days, basically, 393 days. And in that time, those were still rallies within an ongoing bear market. In other words, the market did not make a new high. It broke down to a lower low after that. So you really have to keep in mind that these really strong rebounds are short covering and, you know, speculative funds flowing back in. And that impulse to gamble has not been quelled yet. I've spoke of this before. We see this in positioning where portfolios are still more than 60% weighted towards equities. They still have junky debt in them. They still have very little in the way of cash and treasuries. And that is all indicia of a high rather than a low as well, because we know that historically at lows, you start to see not only the prices come off significantly, which lowers the allocation percentage to equities in terms of market value, but you also get this forced selling and liquidation and panic selling where people start finally going out of the market. And that's what ultimately sets up the bottom. So it's important to understand those dynamics that are now working and why they do that occur that way. I think one of the really larger factors that is a kind of a wild card in here, not in terms of changing the overall downtrend, which is happening for very excellent fundamental reasons that is well deserved, not the least of which being valuations, which are still obscene. Just even like the S&P, the analyst community is today expecting 10% earnings per share growth in 2023. That's super bullish off record profits that have prevailed for the past few years. So even if you think about that, not only are they not seeing a recession, but they're seeing record growth on record profits in this environment. And they're pricing that forward and saying, well, the S&P is only trading at 18 times our forecast earnings in 2023. But if you get a contraction in earnings along with the lines that's typical in this type of environment, you could get, you know, S&P earnings of 200 instead of 250. And the multiple then is, if you look at it, is going to be, you know, presently well, like towards 30, when the historical norm is sort of 16, and at bear market bottoms and recessionary bottoms, it's something like 12 to 15 times. So if you apply that kind of rationale to the S&P today, you can see that you could get a further 50% decline from here in terms of price. I know that's mind-blowing to people, but that would be not unusual given the extremity of the overshoot that we saw during the past couple of years leading into the 2022 downturn. So that's all sort of background, but the one factor that I was going to allude to that's really quite short-term wildcardish is the reality, as I mentioned, the quantitative tapering is going on in the background. Even when the Fed pauses, it tells us they intend to keep this runoff of their balance sheet, reducing the amount of bonds that they bought during QE and during, you know, pumping liquidity into financial markets. They're now doing that reversal, $95 billion a month coming back out. And that is actually equivalent to 200 basis points of tightening on top of the rate hikes they've already done to date. So as that moves through, that's more liquidity coming out of the financial system. But there's a kind of a wild thing happening right now, which, as we know, Jim, there's this standoff with the debt ceiling in the United States, which is, you know, something that happens every year. They don't agree to pay the bills they've already, the money they've already spent. And there's this big political theater about, you know, whether or not they're going to increase the debt cap. The thing is that the Treasury General Account is an asset that sits at the U.S. Treasury. It's an asset of the U.S. Treasury, that's held at the Federal Reserve. And when the government draws it down, because, for example, they can't issue more bonds at this time because there's this cap on their agreement to increase that level of debt they're allowed to take, that leads to an increase in the reserve balances, which increases liquidity in the financial system. So just in January, we've got this wild card of this short-term situation where the standoff on the debt ceiling is actually increasing liquidity in the financial system. Now, it's a race against the QT that's happening, and, you know, it's not clear how long this will continue. In other words, it's temporary, and to the extent who wins in this horse race in the next couple of weeks, it's very hard to predict that, but it is definitely a loosening factor of liquidity in financial markets, and that sort of tempering the tapering that we're seeing on the QT portion of the balance sheet. So that, you know, at some point here, that's going to reverse because they're going to agree to increase the cap on the debt, and also because the Treasury actually has to sell some more bonds in 2023 in the early part. They're increasing spending. And so that will ultimately, you know, when that anomaly ends, we're going to see a magnification of the QT impact. So I'm just saying that's something that's happening in January, and it's not long for this world, and it is a factor to keep an eye on in terms of, to the extent it's provided liquidity in the short run to financial assets, it will soon become an extra drag on the other side.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, the International Monetary Fund says the UK is going to be the only major economy that doesn't grow this year. They said even Russia is going to have better growth. Is this the hangover from Brexit?
Sorry, did you say the IMF?
Yes.
Yeah, well, actually, it's interesting. The IMF, well, the UK has had a very challenging period for a whole bunch of factors, not the least of which debt in households and the ridiculously valued real estate, similar to what we've seen in Canada. We're worse in Canada, but many of those factors. Then they've got the Brexit, and they've got the slowdown in global demand. They've had this spike in cost of fuel, oil and gas prices. All these things have been very negative for the UK economy. That is, lessening to some extent here, because natural gas prices, for example, have come off the boil incredibly fast. And that will help them. Also, the IMF is predicting the price of oil is going to drop 16% in 2023. So that's also part and parcel of this downturn in the global demand cycle, typical of past peak economic output. You start to see this contraction in demand, and oil prices have already been coming off significantly from where they peaked in March during the height of the Ukraine invasion, fear about inflation. So that is going to help the UK for sure as the price of these fuels come off. But I thought it was interesting that the world GDP estimate for 2023 was 2.9%. That's what they're forecasting, the IMF. That's still down from 3.4 in 2022, right? So they're definitely talking about a contraction in terms of the pace of growth, and they don't see it getting better in 2024 to a great degree, as they're currently forecasting 3.1% GDP growth for 2024. So I think this is, I go back to the, all these factors are really pointing to a slowing of demand, a slowing of spending, and a slowing of revenue and corporate earnings. And all of that ultimately is a good thing, because we do need to have this contraction back to reasonable levels, because we got so extended during the pandemic and during all the financial gimmicks that were going on. But, we've spoke of this before. What's the upside to some of this? The upside is that, for example, you can get cash yields today that are more than 4.5% on, money in the bank, so to speak. Not in bank accounts, but in short-term money market type products. And, if you look at the stock market, the S&P 500 yield today is about 3.4%. Well, the 10-year note in the U.S. is 3.5. The 2-year note is 4.2. So you can actually make a much better yield with a fraction of the capital risk by staying short in terms of bonds and GICs and, as I said, money market, and not having to face the prospects of another 20, 30, 40, 50% drawdown in terms of the price of some of these really sketchy assets. So that's the good news in this, and I wasn't surprised to see the IMF's forecast. Now, that doesn't mean they'll be accurate. These are very difficult things to forecast, and there are things like, certain things that could happen to make matters worse, which would be, for example, the ongoing tensions that are happening in Asia with respect to Taiwan, the standoff around semiconductors, and the U.S. bringing in more laws, and other countries getting on side. So there's definitely this growing tension in the world. And if we started to see some kind of conflict erupt right out in the open over the Taiwan standoff, that could be something that would again cause a spike in inflation. But I think that the problem there is that it will actually be a greater weight in terms of the overall economy and the rest of people's spending ability. And of course, the other factor here is that the unemployment rate is expected to increase by about 1%. The central banks are seeing that, and all the major forecasting agencies that do these projections are seeing that. And that again aligns with a recession. And even when the central banks don't say they see a recession, they say that they see this increase in the unemployment rate, which ultimately is a late cycle indicator, again, of an economic contraction.
Danielle, my question is, are higher interest rates themselves an inflationary factor? Because I'm going to ask my boss for more pay to pay for my increased mortgage payments.
Well, you can try, but yeah. We're not seeing that in the labor data. We're definitely not seeing that we're keeping up with the cost of living here, or that the workers have any real traction in the big picture, other than the odd sector or industry. But basically, a lot of companies are laying off people. We have the lowest unionization rates now, lower than pre-COVID. So again, bargaining power is in decline still. So it's been interesting to watch, right? It seemed like workers were getting a bit of a toehold or some increased bargaining power, and they certainly did in some of the the lower paying sectors like hotel and travel, that sort of thing, because there was a dearth of people willing to do that work when the reopening started. But now we're not seeing that follow through to increases. So I think at right now it's a positive for the average saver and worker because the rate of inflation is coming down and the amount of money they can earn on any savings is the best we've seen since 2007. Unfortunately, on the opposite side of that, we have the reality that most people don't have much savings to begin with. And there's new ODC data came out, Jim, that looked at the most recent available information on who has a mortgage and who doesn't in different countries. And actually, in Canada, they found the latest data suggests that there's only 25% of the households who own homes do so free and clear. So that means 75% of the homeowners in the country are now facing, they've already either faced a higher interest rate or they're facing a renewal coming up in the next year potentially where they would have to face a higher interest rate. So to the extent that people have locked in terms for another, you know, hopefully for 3 or 4 years at low rates, that may help them bridge through this period, and then rates may be coming back down by the time it comes up. But for anyone that's got money coming up, a loan coming up for renewal, you know, imminently, it's going to be facing very likely higher rates than they've been paying in the past. So that's all kind of putting the pressure on the household sector, it's not being made up because the employment sector is weakening. We're seeing a lower average hour work week. We're seeing a greater share of part-time versus full-time. And even the temporary workers are now being, the numbers in terms of demand for temporary workers is in decline.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.